Dear brethren and sisters and young people, welcome this evening to the second study under the general theme of Abraham, the father of the faithful. Will you join with us as we sing together hymn 81, to be followed by prayer, the sisters. As an introduction to our brother John Martin's comments this evening, we are to read together Genesis chapter 13. Last evening, brethren and sisters and young people, we came to consider the call of Abraham and his response to that call. Our brother John brought to our attention the principle of separation or assimilation. And we saw him enter into a land that God had called him to, a land that was promised to his seed. We now tonight come to consider Abraham, who is told to arise and walk in it, for unto thee will I give this land. Our brother John Martin.
My beloved brethren and sisters and our dear young people, well, it was from the excellency and the beauty of the Chaldeans that the God of a greater glory, as Stephen says, brought our father Abraham. When he dwelt, brethren and sisters, and sat down, as the Hebrew says, at Haran and delayed there, it was Stephen again who says that God took him captive and impelled him towards the promised land, and into that land he came. We will always remember, will we not, the first stop there between Ebal and Gerizim at Shechem, the great place of eternal decisions, when Abraham had the choice, as our brother Peter has intimated, between separation and assimilation, for the Canaanite was then in the land. And that solitary monument of the oak of which was there, brethren and sisters, at that place, the oak of Moreh, the solitary monument of Moreh, which means a teacher or an archer or the first rains, all saying one and the same thing, pointing the way. The archer with his arrow, the teacher with his lesson, and the first rain with the seasons, telling what is to come and telling Abraham that this is the way, separate yourself from the people of this land. And he passed through that land and came to Bethel. And he learned at Bethel another principle, brethren and sisters. And for the first time in the record of Abraham's life, though we know that he must have dwelt in tents, we are not told until we get here to Bethel, at the house of God. And the Apostle Paul, we learnt, did we not, last evening, picked that up in Hebrews 11 and said that he dwelt in tabernacles or tent with the heirs of the promise, Isaac and Jacob, for he sought a city whose builder and maker is God. And he learnt there the principle, brethren and sisters, of pilgrimage. And he commemorated that with a wonderful altar at that place. And still he journeyed on further and came to the Negev, did he not? To the south, to the dry country. And there was a famine in the land. And it would appear, brethren and sisters, that at the outset of Abraham's journey of faith, Yahweh was to test him all the way. Faith can only be purified by trial. And Abraham was already enduring, we believe, tremendous trials. If they were not physical persecutions, brethren and sisters, they were certainly hammering away at his mind. Unto thy seed will I give this land. He's got no seed. His wife is barren. Unto thy seed will I give this land. The land is swarming with Canaanites. Unto thy seed will I give this land. And the land is absolutely famished. And there's every circumstance of life that swirled about him spoke of the impossibility of that promise being fulfilled. And in the extremity of that moment, in the Negev country, the dry country, he hit upon the expedient that he would go to Egypt, not to stop, but to sojourn there as a stranger, feeling that he might have a respite, brothers and sisters, from the storms of life, but no good came out of Egypt. And he left Egypt, a greatly humiliated man, the father of many nations, having to suffer a rebuke on moral issues. from a Gentile king. And the record said, did it not, that Pharaoh sent him away and all that he had. And what he got out of Egypt, brothers and sisters, was to prove disastrous in his life. For he brought out of Egypt riches, cattle and goods, which became a source of contention between him and his brother, his nephew Lot, who of course was his brother in the faith. And he brought out of Egypt the handmaidens that Pharaoh had given him, one of whom, Hagar the Egyptian, was to prove, brethren and sisters, a tremendous thorn in the flesh for that married couple. No good ever comes out of going into Egypt. And in chapter 10 and verse 12, we read that he went down into Egypt. Chapter 12, rather, and in verse 10, he went down into Egypt. And in chapter 13 and verse 1, we read that Abraham went up out of Egypt, brethren and sisters. And in those two geographical settings, going down and going up, we have the story of Abraham recovering from that trial, brethren and sisters. And though he may have gone on and made other mistakes, and though he may have gone on again and denied his wife, he never went down into Egypt. He learnt that lesson. And years and years went by, brothers and sisters, and his seed never learnt that lesson. And if they had walked in the steps of that faith of their father Abraham, they would have never wanted to go back to Egypt. And it was, as it were, as if in this story of Abraham, that God is setting the mould or the pattern of every son and daughter of faith. You'd never go to Egypt. It may appear to be a place of respite, a never-ending supply of the good things of this life. No need of rain. It all comes down from the hinterland of Africa and spreads itself out into a land of plenty. But it never does you any good, brethren and sisters. And as we learn from Zechariah 14, in the age to come, when the Lord Jesus Christ will be in the earth with all the saints, that Zechariah 14 brings together, that never again will Egypt ever become a curse upon the people of God, and never again will there be a Canaanite in the house of Yahweh. And Abraham was to learn those lessons sorely. But learnt them, brethren and sisters, he did. And that's the greatness of our father Abraham. Now, when you read chapter 13, you cannot miss the lesson of those early verses. Look, in the third verse of chapter 13, and it says, he went on his journeys. He went on his journeys. That doesn't mean to say, brethren and sisters, that Abraham set out just to go for a little walk somewhere. Because in the Hebrew it says, he went through his stations. And when you read that chapter, you can't help but being impressed that Abraham is hurrying back to the place of Bethel. He wanted to get back where he made that mistake between Bethel and Ai, between the house of God and ruin, and he wanted to put that matter right. He never wanted to do that again. And going back between the house of God and ruin, he hurried back through each station. And you read the stations. He went up out of Egypt, verse 1. He went into the south. He came from the south even to Bethel. He came to that place where his tent had been, between Bethel and Ai, under the altar, station by station by station. He's deliberately retracing his steps. And that record in Genesis is brilliantly written, telling us that. And he got back there, reconstructed that altar, and I believe a very determined and a very chastened and a very humble man determined that never again would he make that mistake. And men, brethren and sisters, who learn that lesson in their lives by bitter experience ought to retrace their steps station by station by station and get back where they started. And to resolve in their heart and mind that never again will they make those mistakes. And so he went on his journeys, deliberately retracing those steps. 180-odd mile he went, brethren and sisters, until he came even to Bethel. Even to Bethel. To the house of God, where his tent had been at the beginning. What an eloquent phrase that is. With all the permanence of Egypt, with its never-ending supplies of the commodities of this life, but he gets back to where his tent had been at the beginning. back to a life of pilgrimage, brethren and sisters. A little bit harder, perhaps, but a lot more satisfying. And back he came, fortified to stand between Bethel and Ai, and able now to say to another man, you make the decision. You say whatever you like, I'll leave it to you. And standing there knowing exactly the principles, he had no fear, brethren and sisters, now that God would determine a course for him which would not end in a disaster as that one did, but would end with him ultimately standing in that land, the possessor of all of it. Fortified he was now to do that. And he went back to relive that moment of worship. And it says that he came there, he made that altar, and he called on the name of Yahweh, as he did before, exactly that. At the end of verse 8 of chapter 12, he built an altar unto Yahweh, and he called upon the name of Yahweh. And now he's home again, back to where he started. And you can just imagine that prayer, brethren and sisters, as he knelt beside that altar of unhewn stones where God recorded his name. And we can only surmise what he would have said and how he would have thought. But I don't think we'd be very far from the mark, as we would see a man very humble indeed, humbled by a bitter experience, suffering a stinging rebuke from people outside the truth on moral issues, and having to come back and bow before his God and saying, I should have never left this place, back to where his tent was at the beginning. Now verse 5 of chapter 13 tells us, and Lot also, which went with Abraham, and he had flocks and herds and tents. You know, brothers and sisters, we do an injustice to Lot to criticize him too muchly. As Peter said, he was a righteous and a just man. He tortured his soul in Sodom. He was a faithful man. He stuck with Abraham. He went to Egypt with him and he came out of Egypt with him. But he never forgot Egypt. It came into his mind, brethren and sisters, at a very, very inopportune time. I'll show you that in a minute. He never forgot it. You know, we have people say, oh, it's good for our children to taste of the world. Rubbish. Like telling your child to have a drink of poison to see that it doesn't work on them. Some children, brethren and sisters, some grown-up people who have those experiences never forget them. There are indelible impressions made. And an indelible impression was made upon the mind of Lot. And that indelible impression, brethren and sisters, led that man into tragic circumstances. And now the very riches, the very prosperity which they had acquired in Egypt, as well in the land, became, brethren and sisters, a matter of adversity between them. Isn't it terrible? An uncle and a nephew who before this time dwelt together through the difficulties of life in the famine, stuck through thick and thin, went down to Egypt together and came out of Egypt together, are divided by prosperity. Prosperity divided them. There's a lesson in that, brethren and sisters. And even that prosperity that divided was in itself a blessing from God. And many men have gone the way of all flesh, taken away with the blessings from God which they have misused. Blessings which they ought to see, brothers and sisters, are things for to be thankful about, to use them wisely and well in the service of God, knowing that the earth is Yahweh's and the fullness thereof. But not all people think like that. And now we come to a time of a test, and we're told here that the land in verse 6 was not able to bear them, that they might dwell together. The land was not able to bear them. The promised land. See, we don't understand, do we? If you were to uproot your home and travel on foot for hundreds of miles through difficult circumstances with a large retinue of servants and relatives, through a difficult terrain, and you were to come into a promised land and find that it couldn't support two families and the place is swarming with other people, what would you think? You'd think, well, first of all, this is a good state of affairs, this is. In the present circumstances, the land can't bear me and my nephew. This is what you could have thought. And secondly, how could it ever do it? Because we learn that the Canaanite and the Perizzite dwelt in the land. And those two races of people, brothers and sisters, were noted for their large herds and flocks. Abraham and Lot were known, not the only sharers of that land. And this is the promised land. And so they found difficulties. And in verse 7, there was a strife. Oh, yes. That strife, brethren and sisters, commenced between the herdmen of Lot and Abraham. It's to their credit that that strife didn't originate within the men themselves. Abraham and Lot did not initially lock horns over who was to go where in that land. It was the herdsmen that did that first. But Abraham was a wise man, brethren and sisters, and he saw that it would be inevitable that that strife would come down to personalities in the end. He knew that. And that strife was the beginning of the end for Lot. It doesn't pay, brethren and sisters, to have trouble with Abraham. I'm not suggesting at all that this, what I'm going to say now, applies in its fullness to Lot, because it doesn't. But there's a sense, brethren and sisters, that it does apply to him. When God said, I will bless them that bless thee, and I will curse him that curseth thee. I reiterate, that did not apply to Lot, that latter expression. But nonetheless, they are blessed who are blessed with faithful Abraham. And he left faithful Abraham. And whilst people, I will bless them, plural, that bless thee, I will curse him, singular, that curseth thee. None will escape the consequences who separate from Abraham, not even Lot. And Lot, brethren and sisters, got into trouble, didn't he? And strife was the beginning of the end for him, and it caused that separation between him and Abraham. And we are blessed with faithful Abraham, says the apostle. We're not blessed without him. And look where that led Lot. Lot was a very rich man, so the record tells us. And we know, brethren and sisters, what riches can do. We see riches like the Nile Delta that the bank presents to us, a never-ending supply of the commodities of this world, so that we can have confidence in our future and the future of our families. And we build our confidence upon that basis. And there's not a brother or a sister, however they might express themselves eloquently concerning the faith, is without some concern about that security that never-ending supply of monetary value can do for us. But the Apostle Paul pointed out that when that becomes a dominant feature in our lives, brothers and sisters, we err from the faith and pierce ourselves through with many sorrows. Did that happen to Lot? He lost his home, then his wife. His daughters had married outside the truth. And even when they left with him, brethren and sisters, in a horrendous circumstance, they committed incest with their own father. And it didn't end there. God forgives Lot, brethren and sisters, and he's in God's kingdom. But forgiveness does not mean that we escape the consequences of our foolishness. Forgiveness means that God will give us his grace and will not hold that against us for eternity, and we'll be in his kingdom and it'll all be forgotten. But we will never escape the consequences of our folly. Didn't end there. As a result of that incestuous union, there were two boys born called Moab and Ammon. Both names meaning, having a connotation meaning from father. Those two boys came into great nations, brethren and sisters, listed in Psalm 83 in a gallery of Israel haters called the children of Lot.
listed among all the haters of Israel, the children of Lot. Look at the consequences of that folly. And when Zephaniah the prophet lined up all the nations for condemnation, Gaza and Ashkelon, Tyre and all the other nations surrounding Israel, when he came to Edom and Moab, he said this. He warned those two nations that they should be extremely careful about their attitude to Israel, because, he said, I will make you like Sodom and Gomorrah. And if ever there were two nations on the face of God's earth that should have known what that meant, they should have, because they were conceived, brothers and sisters, under the shadow of that Holocaust. Those nations should never have missed the point of that. And so the consequences of separation from Abraham are enormous. And that's why in this chapter, brothers and sisters, it ends up with the emphasis upon walking with him. That's why it ends up like that. As if God is giving us a cameo of our own personal lives. So then they that be of faith are blessed with faithful Abraham. But none will escape who depart from the course of that faith. I will curse him, singular, that curseth thee. None will escape. Lot escaped, brothers and sisters, ultimately. But what a dreadful price he had to pay. You know, it was Abraham who made the decision, the suggestion about separation. We learn, for example, at the end of the seventh verse that the Canaanite and the Perizzite dwelt then in the land. We'd learnt previously that the Canaanite dwelt in the land. Other tribes were coming in, brothers and sisters. It was getting crowded. And you know, if ever there was a time when brethren should have stuck together, it's now. Nonetheless, Abraham could see, wise man that he now was, that it was better, brethren and sisters, to separate than to fight. Later on, we're going to learn that God held Lot responsible for that separation, not Abraham. He didn't hold Abraham responsible for it, yet Abraham suggested it. And you see, in Abraham's suggestion, brethren and sisters, there was not a suggestion that there should be a division. That's an appalling thought. But he knew that if they wouldn't separate, it would become worse than division. It would break out into open war between brethren. And he says, we're brethren. We didn't ought to do that. We be brethren, he said, at the end of verse 8. And brethren, we're told in the psalm, ought to dwell together in unity. And then, brothers and sisters, we have one of the most remarkable demonstrations of faith possible. As he gave Lot the widest and the first choice, is not the whole land before thee? You know, it does us well, brethren and sisters, and I mean this sincerely. I think we are foolish Christadelphians if we don't take the opportunity from time to time to sit down and without going into all the details of the Word of God, with all the Hebrew and the Greek manuscripts, to sit down and consider exactly what that would have meant to Abraham. As he stood there and he's got an enormous responsibility. He loved his wife with a love that defies explanation, as we learn from the record of the prophets. He had a great responsibility towards her. He had a lot of servants, 318 at least of them. He had herds and flocks. He was a man who accepted his responsibilities. And he stood there and said to Lot, you can take what you like. You think of that, brothers and sisters. You watch people in life. You watch people in the little things in life. Watch them in the home, at work, in the office, out on the work floor, anywhere. And see who does that. See who's first up to do the menial tasks. See who it is who stands at the back when everything else is to be taken by others. See who it is that says to the others, you go first. Do what you like. And I'll take what's ever left. Who does that? And we don't do that, brethren and sisters, in the tiny things in life. This man did it with the absolute basic necessities of existence. I don't think we can overemphasize the tremendous act of faith which Yahweh in the heavens must have been extremely pleased with, to hear Abraham say that. And it wasn't, brothers and sisters, just being plainly magnanimous. It wasn't that he was just kind. He'd learnt, because he knew, under thy seed will I give this land. That's what we call faith. That's what it is. He took God at his word, brethren and sisters. Do you know what Paul called him? Got a lot of titles, Abraham. We've gone through a few of them. The friend of God, the Hebrew, the father of the faithful. But Paul coined another title for him. In the 7th chapter of Hebrews, he called him in the Greek, the holder of the promises. The holder of the promises. And here's the holder of the promises saying, take what you like. And that holder of the promises was saying, unto thy seed will I give this land. That's what we call faith. And those sort of things, brothers and sisters, ought to generate in us, as we call him the father of our faith, they ought to generate, to gender within us the same spirit of faith in all avenues of life. Concerning this world, you go first. Have what you want and believe in God. That's the essence of life, brothers and sisters. Well, it was too much for Lot. He probably never stopped to think, brothers and sisters, that A, Abraham was the whole of the promises, and B, he was his senior, he was his uncle, and C, he was, of course, his spiritual head. Probably never stopped to think about that. And I believe in a moment when he was veiled, as his name really means, Lot means veiled, in a veiled moment he forgot those principles. He should have turned around and said to Abraham, oh, no way will I do that. Goodness me, look, God's promised the land to you, you're my uncle, and look, you're my senior in every respect, and you've set me a sterling example. There's no way I could do that. He never thought, why? Because spread before him from Bethel and Ai, up there on the ridge of the Judean hills, just down over the ridge, from where they could stand, where they stood, he could see over the ridge, brethren and sisters, and down it went, then a great sharp escarpment to the bottom of the floor, and then whoosh, oh, was absolutely beautiful. It was glorious. And the strife led to the next thing, and to the next thing, and to the next thing, and down and down and down went Lot. And once you're on the down, brethren and sisters, it's awful hard to stop. Look at the steps. Verse 7, strife. Verse 10, he lifted up his eyes. Verse 11, Lot chose him all the plain of Jordan. Verse 12, he pitched his tent towards Sodom. Chapter 14 and verse 12, he dwelt in Sodom. And chapter 19 and verse 1, and there came two angels to Sodom at even, and Lot sat in the gate of Sodom. Totally assimilated, at least physically, with all the sociality of that place. So strife causes us to turn our back upon the man of faith. We lift up our eyes and we see marvellous things in this life. We choose them. Oh, we won't rush in. We only pitch our tent towards Sodom. We don't go all the way at the start. But in the end, we get there. And lo and behold, as time goes on, we are sitting right in the gate of that city. They are the steps, brethren and sisters, of Lot's decline, veiled, in whom the God of this world hath blinded, said the apostle, concerning those who were taken away with things like that. And what did he see? You know, the record is almost telling us how Lot's mind was working. He lifted up his eyes, and we read in verse 10 of chapter 13, and he beheld all the plain of Jordan. All the plain of Jordan. You know, the word plain of Jordan, brethren and sisters, and it's used later on in another expression, means the circle of Jordan. Because you've got to remember this, that what Lot would have seen was vastly different what you would see today when you look down towards Sodom and Gomorrah. It looked nothing like it looks today. He would have seen a beautiful lake, because the top half of the Dead Sea, brethren and sisters, is very deep. And that little peninsula that sticks out divides the top half from the bottom half, and it's very deep at the top, but during the course of the summer you could walk the entire width of the bottom part. And the geologists, of course, tell us that the character of the top and bottom are absolutely dissimilar, and the bottom part didn't exist. That's where Sodom and Gomorrah were. So all he could see was a very deep lake. And it was beautiful. The circle of Jordan, as the expression has it. You know, as Jesus was there, wasn't he, later on with John the Baptist? And John the Baptist was down there, and it says they came from all the roundabout Jordan, from the circle of Jordan, to whom he addressed and said, "Say not to yourselves that you're Abraham's children." That would have had memories for them, wouldn't it? Because there was another one who looked down at the circle of Jordan, and he saw it down there, brethren and sisters, as something exceedingly beautiful. How did he see it? Well, he saw it in two ways. He first of all saw that it was well watered everywhere before Yahweh destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah, that is. And you see, it was like two things. It was like the garden of Yahweh, and it was like the land of Egypt. And do you know, brethren and sisters, that's right. Because you know the Nile Delta. Here comes the Nile from the hinterland of Africa, and it spreads out on the delta, fans out in all its canals, and wherever it runs, of course, almost at ground level the canals are, there's fertility. Go to the land of Ur of the Chaldees, to the garden of Yahweh, the garden of Eden. There were four rivers. And as the great rivers, the river Tigris and the Euphrates, came down and conjoined before the top of the gulf, they fanned out in all these canals. So Egypt and the garden of Yahweh were very similar in Lot's mind. They weren't two different things. He equated them. And at times, brethren and sisters, at times, we do see this life as if it were the kingdom of God. And though we might mouth platitudes, and saying we're all waiting for Christ's coming, it isn't a terrible world we live in. There are times when things go well, especially for some of us, go very well, when the garden of Yahweh is very much like the land of Egypt. And the land of Egypt is very much like the garden of Yahweh. If he'd have never been to Egypt, he would never have made that comparison. And neither would you or me. And therein lay his problem. Not with an accent, but that's written like that, brethren and sisters. When he lifted up his eyes, that's how he saw it. And he made a decision between Bethel and Ai, and he chose him all the plain of Jordan, and Lot journeyed east. There's something else about that Jordan that was interesting. You know, if you look at the Jordan Valley, you see an aerial picture of it. From the bottom of the Sea of Galilee till you come to the top of the Dead Sea is about a distance of 60 miles. I don't talk in kilometres, I was born a few years ago. 60 miles down there. But Jordan actually travels a tortuous course which is about 240 miles long. Pretty obvious, brethren and sisters, that something drastic happened to the terrain there, because it wouldn't have done that had there been such a drop as it is from 600 feet below at the bottom of the Sea of Galilee to nearly 1,400 feet below at Jordan, only 60 miles further. That river would have gone straight like that. But it didn't. So obviously there's been a tremendous upheaval there. And it left that river in that tortuous course. And although it looked beautiful from where Lot stood, when God blasted the bottom end of the Dead Sea and he stagnated that water, brethren and sisters, and it piled up all those chemicals and killed every living thing in them, and it built up back into the sludge into the river as it oft times did in the flood periods, then Jordan still looked beautiful from a distance because the top of the bracken was glorious. Zechariah called it and Jeremiah called it the pride of Jordan. But both prophets warned about what was underneath that bracken. And beneath that green top, which you see from the Judean hills or from the hills of Moab, brothers and sisters, there is a black, slimy, oomy mud, which stinks with rotting vegetation and is a breeding place for scorpions and snakes. And Jeremiah said, though they weary thee in the land of peace, what will you do in the pride of Jordan? Don't go near that. And what looked beautiful to the eyes of Lot, brothers and sisters, wasn't so beautiful when he got down there. And Jordan, you know, in its best moments, before the Holocaust of Sodom and Gomorrah, was never considered to be anything beautiful. But throughout the record of God's word, turn up any page you like about the River Jordan, it is only seen as a barrier between the promised land and the land of death. It is only seen as a symbol of the flesh, which runs from the living sea of Galilee through Adam, the city Adam, into the stagnation of death, where the Lord Jesus Christ came to step into the water to proclaim with John that all flesh is grass. That's what Jordan stood for, brethren and sisters. And Lot saw that as if it was the garden of Yahweh because he thought it looked like Egypt. What a tragic mistake, brothers and sisters. It would have been better for Lot never have seen Egypt. But he'd seen it and never forgot it. And in verse 12 we read this. And I'll read it with emphasis. Listen to it. Abraham dwelt in the land of Canaan. And Lot dwelt in the cities of Plain. Deliberate contrast there, brothers and sisters. One man stuck to the land, and the other man, he went and dwelt in a city. Now, I don't want anybody at the end of this study to uproot and all disperse into isolation, because the principle's not exactly like that today. But nonetheless, it was then. One dwelt in the land, and the other one dwelt in cities. You know, God's estimation, brothers and sisters, of the cities of mankind isn't hard to determine. In the law of Jubilee, for example, there were gradations of sale and resale as to what could be done and what couldn't be done. A long legal list about such transactions. One among which said this, the land shall not be sold forever, for it's mine. But when the regulations came concerning cities, it could be sold and resold, but never the land. Isaiah 14, speaking of Babylon, when God through the prophet said that he would so destroy Babylon that it would never rise again, he said, lest they fill the earth with their cities. So Babylon was destroyed, among other things, to stop the urbanization of society. That's why God destroyed him, lest he fill the world with his city, said the prophet. Abraham dwelt in the land, and Lot dwelt in the city. And there was the difference between the two men at that time. Lot, of course, didn't go straight to Sodom, brothers and sisters. He pitched his tent towards Sodom. You ever seen people do that? Of course you have. Any brother or sister that's ever exercised any responsibility in ecclesial life will inevitably come up with someone who pitches their tent towards Sodom. They're going to embark on a career into avenues of life which is not altogether conducive to spirituality. Oh, but they won't go all the way. We'll only do this much. Or we may have young people who have tremendous sporting abilities, who excel in these things at school to the great overweening pride of their parents and cheer them on to victory. But only go a certain way. When it comes to organized sport, no one. Many, of course, abide by that. Someday. But whatever our children or ourselves do, brethren and sisters, that's going to go in any direction, that's going to take us into juxtaposition of wicked sinners exceedingly, then don't go any other way. How many people say, oh yes, but I won't do this. I don't intend to do all that. I don't intend to do this. And I really haven't got any intent. Neither did Lot have any intention. He pitched his tent. Tent, brethren and sisters. He still was a pilgrim. He'd still made a decision to stay with Abraham in that sense. But his pilgrimage was going towards Sodom. Until in the end, he's got a home. And there he is sitting at that gate. And as I've made the suggestion, and it's only a suggestion because I couldn't prove a word of it, there's no mention of Lot's wife ever until you come to Sodom. And one wonders where he got her. Wherever he got her from, brothers and sisters, there's no question as to where her heart was born. And so Lot becomes very much settled, doesn't he? And isn't it a tragic thing when you read that verse, that word in verse 13, But the men of Sodom were wicked and sinners before Yahweh exceedingly. And you know, brothers and sisters, there are many fine things in life that we can do which in themselves are excluded from our pilgrimage, not because of the things themselves necessarily, but of the associations into which we will be taken. Let's go back again to that illustration. Organised sport. What's wrong with organised sport? I love to see kids playing sport. I hate to see kids sitting around hanging on to each other. I like to see youngsters up and active. I think that's grand. And I think one of the things that is missing today from our youth is that vigorous thing which needs young people to exercise their lungs. I think it's great, brothers and sisters. But I remember the time when I was lined up before I came into the truth, but knew it, with only about 25 other men selected to remain with the last 30 after they'd pruned all the rest out of the hundreds that had come to the training, that I might stay on the training list of one of the league football teams. And I remember the coach grabbing me by the jumper in the middle of the oval when he gave us all an exhortation. Individually, he took each man by the jumper and brought him up to his face. And in his fanatical way, he told us all what was expected of us for that football club. Body, soul and spirit we had to give. And coming to me, why on earth he would ever select these words, I will not know. But he grabbed me by the chest, dragged me up and said, as for you, he said, this will be your religion. I'll never, ever forget that as long as I live. I knew the truth when he said that, brothers and sisters. And that's where it's wrong. The game itself, great for your limbs and lungs. But they were wicked sinners exceedingly, who bought you body, soul and spirit, dedicated to a bag of wind. Your religion. That's what's wrong with it. But they were wicked sinners exceedingly. And we know what Ezekiel says about the sin of Sodom, brethren and sisters, don't we? Pride. Fullness of bread. Abundance of idleness. They were haughty and committed abomination. You would think that that would be the comments upon the daily papers of our generation, wouldn't you, brethren and sisters? Arrogant pride, thundering good economy. For your information, we're going through a recession. I don't know who'd ever know it. Thundering good economy. Abundance of idleness in Australia, the greatest country on the earth. 4 weeks annual leave with loading. Long service leave. Public holidays. Paid days off. Flexi time. Goodness gracious me. No country in the world's like that, brothers and sisters. Abundance of idleness. And are we haughty? They dragged the whole football club up an aeroplane, didn't they? Because they thought they had a divine right to wreck it. That's the Aussie. We live here. The wicked sinners exceedingly. And do we commit abomination? In the particular abomination spoken of here, brethren and sisters, which we hesitate to name, they tell us, according to the experts, that Sydney runs second only to San Francisco. This is where we live. Here. What manner of people ought we to be? We didn't have to make Lot's choice, brothers and sisters. We got born into this situation. God doesn't hold that against us. What a challenge it is to us that in the midst of this crooked and perverse generation, we should live out the principle of a tent existence, giving others the choice of this foul society and having nothing whatever to do with it ourselves. That's the principle we learn from Lot. And don't start the downward trend, strife. And when that comes, when there's strife between brethren and sisters, that's the end. And if ever there was a time when the brethren of Christ, the Christadelphians, ought to pull together, now it's that time, brethren and sisters, because we got the Canaanite and the Perizzite in the land. And we ought to know better that none of us can exist on our own, and we need each other to walk with faith, with faithful Abraham. But now Lot is gone. Verse 14. And I want you to note how this is put. And Yahweh said unto Abram, after that Lot was separated from him. See how that's written? It doesn't say that Yahweh said unto Abraham after that Lot had asked, after that Abraham had asked Lot to go. God holds that man responsible for that separation, brethren and sisters. Because I don't think anyone could ever believe that a man who could stand there and say, it's all yours, you pick what you like, I don't believe anyone could ever think that he would start trouble over prosperity. A man like that, brethren and sisters, would never, ever make a row over prosperity. He wouldn't have ever said that if he was a man like that. It's pretty obvious where the trouble arose. And after that Lot was separated upon him, Yahweh offers Abraham the privilege to lift up now thine eyes. And I can imagine the angel saying that to him. As we believe, of course, that the appearances of Yahweh were through his angelic beings. And I can imagine the angel putting that emphasis upon it. Now, Abraham, lift up your eyes. And I can imagine Abraham lifting them up. And look from the place where thou art. And where was he? He was at the place Bethel, which I've told you before, brethren and sisters, that in the later record of Genesis, it's always referred to as the place of Bethel, which used to be called the city of Luz. And what had a name as a city took upon itself another title as a place. And it was the place of the house of God, whose builder and maker at that stage hadn't built it, but there he was. And the place where thou art, Abraham, you lift up your eyes. And where was he to look, brethren and sisters? He was to look northward. And he would stand at Bethel, and he would turn to his left, and his eye would travel up the Judean hills. He would see a slight break in the hills up north where the tiny valley of Jezreel tucked itself down into the Jordan Valley. He would see the great mountains of Galilee piling up to Hermon. He'd get a majestic view of the Hermon range. Northward. Southward. He'd turn around, he'd look straight down the other way. And he would look down as the mountains went up slightly till they came about level with Hebron, and then, of course, they tilted away until almost the land rose to meet them and flattened out on the great broad valleys, or the great broad, plateau, rather, that led down to the Sinai Peninsula. Eastward! And he turned his eyes and looked straight where Lot had looked. So he got it anyway, didn't he? He didn't go without, did he? And you know, brethren and sisters, that's a rule of life. That's a rule of life. You make a decision like Abraham and see whether you miss out. You may not get exactly what the other person chooses, and you may. But more than compensation, you'll get. I can't reflect on any experience in my life where that hasn't happened. What do you do when a letter appears at your AB table from another ecclesia about some great event which you may have planned that clashes with theirs. What do you decide? I know what we do. I'm not making a boast about that, but I know what we do. And I know what a lot do. That's our day! You give it up, and you'll never lose it. Eastward! He lifted up his eyes, and there he was. Spread out, like the garden of Yahweh, not like Egypt, like the garden of Yahweh, all his. Didn't miss a thing, brothers and sisters. And then westward. Turn around and look back. Now across the Judean hills. And he'd be about level with all these places, you know. Looking across the Judean hills, he would see the blue line of the Mediterranean. There was the border of the land, right to the sea. To thee will I give it, and to thy seed. You know, in the 28th chapter of Genesis, brethren and sisters, Jacob was promised that land, and the wonderful expressions were used about the four winds of the heavens. And I'm going to quote you another scripture a little later on. And you know, these words were repetitious of what was said to Abraham. Genesis 28 and verse 14, and thy seed shall be as the dust of the earth, and thou shalt spread abroad to the west, to the east, to the north, and to the south. And in thee and in thy seed shall all families of the earth be blessed. And in the four winds of the compass, brethren and sisters, God would see that there was going to be a great seed which would come from the four corners of the earth. All nations would be blessed. And the Lord Jesus Christ stood there among those Sadducees that divided this world among themselves and fed themselves from the coffers of the treasuries of the temple in Jerusalem and said, you will see Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob in the kingdom of God, and you yourselves thrust out, and many shall come from the east and shall the west, and shall sit down in the kingdom of God with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And he only mentioned two points of the compass, because to the Jews, to the east was the unknown land, and to the west, the expanse of the sea, where people came out of the blue, brethren and sisters. Many shall come and shall sit down with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob and dwell in that kingdom. And Abraham saw all that. To thee will I give it and to thy seed. Now I want you to notice the progression. In Genesis chapter 12, God said, first of all, before he said anything else, to thy seed will I give this land. Then he said, to thee and to thy seed will I give that land. Now there are three gradations there, brothers and sisters. And to thy seed, which is Christ. We are joint heirs with him. He's the one that inherits the land. We get it because of our relationship to him. Even Abraham's not in that category. And then to Abraham personally. And then to all those like him. And that was the progression of the promise concerning the land. To thy seed, to thee, and to thy seed. And that's how it goes, doesn't it? And to Abraham's seed, who's Christ, to Abraham, and all those who are Abraham's will inherit those promises. That's how it went, brethren and sisters. And then God said this in the 13th chapter of Genesis, absolutely beautiful expression, and I will make thy seed as the dust of the earth. Did you notice that in the 28th chapter of Genesis, where we quoted again from Jacob's promises, that the same thing was said in relation to the east, the west, the north, and the south, that the seed of Abraham was to be made like the dust of the earth. It's only later, brothers and sisters, that that seed is likened to the stars of the heaven. You see, there's a progression, isn't there? So the call to Abraham's seed is from the dust of the earth to a divine destiny to sparkle like the stars of the firmament in Daniel chapter 12, like the stars of heaven. Oh yes, we know that of course the prime reason is the fact that you can't count the dust or the stars. But isn't it interesting? Now I want to show you something. Abraham's seed is to be like the dust of the earth. Look at Isaiah 44, brethren and sisters. Look at the call of Abraham's spiritual seed in the beautiful way that it's figured here, from the dust of the earth. So in Isaiah 44, you listen to these words, and they're not speaking of natural Israel, brothers and sisters, and you'll quickly see that. It's speaking of Abraham's spiritual seed. Isaiah had this to say, verse 1 of Isaiah 44, "Yet now hear, O Jacob my servant, and Israel whom I have chosen. Thus saith Yahweh that made thee and formed thee from the womb, which will help thee. Fear not, Jacob my servant, and thou Jeshurun whom I have chosen." And that is the natural seed, brethren and sisters, in verses 1 and 2. He's talking to the natural seed, and he formed them in the womb. But look what happens now in verse 3. "For I will pour water upon him that is thirsty, and floods upon the dry ground. And I will pour my spirit upon thy seed, and my blessing upon thine offspring. And they shall spring up as among the grass, as willows of the watercourses." Let's pause there, brethren and sisters. "Thy seed shall be as the dust of the ground." And God said to the natural seed of Jacob, "I'm going to give you more and more and more children. I'm going to rain upon the dry ground." And what's going to happen? Not like Israel, brethren and sisters, who developed from one man to another man, to Jacob, to 12 sons, and developed through endless years into a nation. Oh no. But this nation, boom, grass. The willows of the watercourse. Not there today, tomorrow, whoosh, and they're there. There's a sudden influx of people. As you see those reeds that grow so rapidly in the watercourses, and the apostles went out, brethren and sisters, and they came from the four corners of the earth, and a nation was born at once. And the rain fell upon dry ground, and the dust of the earth came to hear the apostles and the seed of Jacob, and they rushed into the truth with vigor and enthusiasm, like those watercourses and the weeds that fly out of the ground almost. And we read in verse 5, "And one shall say, I am Yahweh. And another shall call himself by the name of Jacob. And another shall subscribe with his hand unto Yahweh and surname himself by the name of Israel." And don't we do that? We are Gentiles. To yesterday, for many of us, we were a dry ground. Today, brethren and sisters, here we are. And we sprang up. 12 months, and I was in the truth. Heard it. Lived with it for 6 years. Couldn't stand it anymore. Went to my first night of education. 12 months later, alive. Sprang up like that. And called myself a brother of Christ. One of Yahweh's people. Spiritual Israel. Chose all those names which didn't apply to me in the past, but now do. Like the dust of the earth. And the water came down upon that dust. And up it came. "Thus saith Yahweh, the King of Israel, and his Redeemer, Yahweh of our armies, I am the first and with the last ones." As Dr. Thomas so beautifully pointed out for us, "And besides me, there's no God. I am the first, and I will be with the last ones." Those who sprang out of the earth because of the influence of the truth and became a nation at once, like the water court, the reeds of the watercourse, out of the dry ground, the grass that sprang up for the blessings of the rain. And so Abraham's seed come from the four corners of the earth, like the dust of the earth, to be made like the stars of heaven. But that expression, stars of heaven, didn't come, brethren and sisters, until Isaac died. I don't mean literally, of course, but beneath the determined hand of Abraham, when he put up virtually had sentenced him to death, it was then and then only that God said they'd be like the stars of heaven. What a change. And coming back to Genesis 13, brethren and sisters, we find a beautiful, absolutely wonderful exhortation at the end of this chapter, from which we took the title of this address, "Walk Through the Land." Walk through the land. Verse 17. What a marvelous exhortation this is. "Arise, walk through the land in the length of it and in the breadth of it, for I will give it unto thee." What do you think God meant by that, brethren and sisters? That Abraham should simply stroll through and enjoy what he was going to get in the future? Oh, no. We know he meant more than that. Why do we know he meant more than that? Because of what was said subsequently to that. You see, the hidden in that expression, there's one of the most powerful exhortations in the Bible, which is echoed by Moses into Joshua into Romans. And that echo is picked up once and again. Walk through the land, for I will give it unto them. Now I'll show you what God meant. In the 11th chapter of Deuteronomy, this is what he meant, brothers and sisters. Faith without works is dead. And when Moses was reminding the people of the wonderful promises which God made to their fathers, this is what he told them, brothers and sisters. In verse 23 of the 11th chapter of Deuteronomy, then will Yahweh drive out all these nations from before you, and ye shall possess greater nations and mightier than yourselves. Every place whereon the soles of your feet shall tread shall be yours. From the wilderness and Lebanon, from the river Euphrates, even unto the utmost sea shall your coast be. And you see what God was saying, brothers and sisters? Every place whereupon the soles of your feet shall tread shall be yours. Walk through the land. And the divine scrutiny, brothers and sisters, looks down from heaven with eyes that need no binoculars. And he looks for the footsteps of the brethren of Christ in the land. And everywhere he finds your imprint will be yours. But he won't be looking in Egypt. He'll be looking for those footsteps, brethren and sisters, in the land. And some of us have never been to the land, and some of us have, and it doesn't matter whether we've been or not. And if we've never been to the land, brethren and sisters, we can leave our footprints all over it. Do you know in the 122nd Psalm, which gave rise to that hymn, Pray for the Peace of Jerusalem, it says, our feet shall stand within thy gates, O Jerusalem. But in the original Hebrew it says, our feet have been standing in thy gates, O Jerusalem. And the pilgrim had never been there. But his footprints were all over that land, brothers and sisters. You listen to a true Christadelphian talk about the land, and it simply oozes out of him or her. And whether they go again and again on the journeys which they take to the land, it doesn't matter. Our footprints can be left all over that land. And it's not only a love of the land, brothers and sisters, but it's working the truth. During the course of this effort, and I'm issuing no accolades now, I'm flattering nobody, but I'm stating facts. During the course of this effort, the feet of the Young Folks Committee are all over the place. And Yahweh looks down. Every place that the soles of your feet shall tread shall be yours. That wasn't the only place it was said, brothers and sisters. No, Joshua chapter 1, Yahweh repeated it. It was never to be forgotten. Never to be forgotten. In verses 1 and 2 of Joshua 1, Joshua is exhorted with these words, Moses, my servant, is dead. Now therefore arise, go over this Jordan, thou and all this people, unto the land which I do give to them, even to the children of Israel. Every place that the sole of your foot shall tread upon that I have given unto you, as I said to Moses. I meant what I said, Joshua. You put your footprints in the land, it's yours. And what do we learn in Romans, brethren and sisters? Turn it up. You've read it hundreds of times. But look what the apostle says in Romans 4. Turn it up and have a look at it. Look at this. Is he not giving the same exhortation? Walk through the land. Look what it says. And he calls Abraham in the 4th chapter of Romans and at verse 12. He says, and the father of circumcision to them who are not of the circumcision only, but who also walk in the steps of that faith of our father Abraham, which he had been yet uncircumcised. Look at the emphasis. People are not merely walking, brothers and sisters, but they're walking carefully. He says they walk in the steps, not of faith, but of that faith. Not anything, it's that faith. They're watching their feet. And who is it that they're walking after? Of our father Abraham. Those words are calculated. And taking the time of Genesis 13 through to the end of Abraham's life, brothers and sisters, get out a notebook, sit down and draw a map of the land, and draw his footsteps. You'll be amazed. To thee will I give it. And when Abraham arises from the dead, there they'll be, the footprints of eternity all over that land. And it will be to all those who walk in the steps of that faith. Oh, absolutely marvellous. We're not finished that point yet. Don't matter. There's a few things to say before we come back to it, brethren and sisters. Come back to Genesis 13. Look what's happening. Is the promise of Abraham having any effect? My word, it is. It's already underway. The great purpose of God didn't wait for the preaching of the apostles, brethren and sisters. It's already started. The father of many nations. He hasn't even got that title yet. But here is the principle. We read in verse 18 of that chapter, the last verse, that immediately upon being told to do what to walk to the land, he removed his tent. And he came and dwelt in the oak, a solitary monument of Mamre. Mamre? You know what that means? It means vigorous. Someone who's vigorous. Do you know where the place got its name from, brethren and sisters? It got its name from a brother in the truth who came into the truth with Abraham, whose name was Mamre. We learn about him in chapter 14 and verse 13. And there came one that had escaped and told Abram the Hebrew, for he dwelt in the plain of Mamre, the Amorite. So the oak of Mamre, there was a place called Mamre, which was named after this brother in the truth. He stood there as a solitary monument, brethren and sisters, as one who had separated himself from the Canaanite was then in the land. And what sort of a Canaanite was he? Well, he was an Amorite. You might say, well, so what? Just this. That of all the people in the land at that time, God was waiting to move with Abraham and his seed, and he was waiting on the basis that the iniquity of the Amorites was to come to its fullness. That man's people, brethren and sisters, were way out in front in all the rotten, stinking abominations of the land. Mamre was vigorous in resisting that influence, and he stood solitary, separate and holy from them, brethren and sisters. And Abraham's seed was already being developed, wasn't it? And you couldn't got drier ground from where he came from. Because God was patiently waiting, for the iniquity of the Amorites had not yet come to the fullness. You see, the power of God's word, brethren and sisters, is irresistible. And the water is falling on dry ground, and the water reeds are rushing up into fruition. And there he is, the man called Mamre. And they came to that place, and we learn there, brethren and sisters, that it was called Hebron. And that brings us back to our walking with Abraham, doesn't it? Because Hebron, of course, was ever associated later on with Abraham. It became almost his city. Oh, but look what's behind Hebron. Goodness me. Talk about the life of Abraham. You know, brethren call this a fundamental study. Deary me. A fundamental study. Hebron! Why would you have Hebron there? Well, of course, the word means fellowship. And we learn concerning Mamre and Eshcol and other Gentiles that they were confederate with Abraham. The word confederate in the Hebrew is Baal Berith, meaning possessors of the covenant. There was fellowship. And Paul talks about the fellowship of the mystery, that the Gentiles should be fellow heirs in the gospel. Here was this secret or mystery already being manifested at Hebron. But why Hebron? Remember, walked through the land. Who walked in Hebron? Whose footsteps, when God looked down upon the conquered land of Canaan, with the microscopic eyes of heaven, brethren and sisters, to discern the faithful men, whose footsteps he found in Hebron? Well, let's show you. Joshua 14. And look what the man said. Did he understand the principle? Did he ever? Look what he said. And this man's footsteps were all over that place. Caleb, brethren and sisters, the son of Jephunneh. Caleb. And he says in verse 9, he reminds Joshua of Moses' words. He says, and Moses sware on that day, surely the land whereon thy feet have trodden shall be thine inheritance and thy children's forever, because thou hast wholly followed Yahweh Elohim. Verse 12. Now therefore, he says, give me this mountain whereof Yahweh spake in that day. For thou heardest in that day how the Anakims were there, and the cities were great and fenced. If so be Yahweh will be with me, then I shall be able to drive them out as Yahweh said. And Joshua blessed him and gave Caleb the son of Jephunneh Hebron for an inheritance. He found his footsteps, brethren and sisters, in Abraham's city. And you know what Joshua could have said to Caleb? He could have brought Caleb before him and says, Caleb, you have walked in the steps of that man, of our father Abraham, right in that city. And his name, brethren and sisters, his name means a dog. There is a dispute as to whether he was actually a Gentile or not. I firmly believe that he was. And if we can't prove that with finality, at least, brethren and sisters, we know this, that his very name, that if he wasn't a Gentile, he certainly was a representative of the Gentiles who always were called dogs. And there in Abraham's city, the fellowship of the mystery that the Gentiles should be fellow heirs in the gospel had its foundation in Caleb, the dog, who put his footsteps clearly in Abraham's in that city. And it didn't end there. Because you know who else came to dwell alongside of him? In Joshua 21, brethren and sisters, we read, in verse 13 of Joshua 21, thus they gave to the children of Aaron the priest Hebron with her suburbs to be a city of refuge for the slayer. Hebron was one of the 48 cities given to the Levites and to the priests. It became selected among the six cities to be one of the cities of refuge. And the one who dwelt there, brethren and sisters, was none other than the high priest of Israel. And there was in Abraham's city the great high priest of their profession dwelling with a dog. And there was the monumental oak of remembrance of the separation from all the Gentiles of this one whose feet was walking in the steps of that faith of our father Abraham, who found fellowship with God through the great high priest of that time. And Paul, in the sixth chapter of Hebrews, which we cannot now speak particularly, said this. He mentions the promises, the cities of refuge, and the great high priest of our profession, all in a matter of about four verses. Brings them all into juxtaposition as they are there. And coming back, brethren and sisters, to the 14th chapter of Joshua, I read very quickly a sentence in that chapter deliberately so you wouldn't really pause and stop there, but now I'll read it slowly. But when Joshua made this request, or rather Caleb made the request to have memorialized the footsteps in Hebron for himself, we read one of the most eloquent expressions in the whole of the Bible, in verse 13 of Joshua 14, and we read there, and Joshua blessed him. And Joshua blessed him. And to quote the Apostle Paul, without all contradiction, the lesser is blessed of the greater. And the one who blessed him, brethren and sisters, being clearly the greater, was none other than Yahushua. In thee and in thy seed shall all nations be blessed. And Yahushua blessed him. And with that, brethren and sisters, we leave our study, not without the exhortation, however, ringing in our ears, walk through the land. When we look now at the three memorial spots, you might call them, the three great places where Abraham has left his imprint indelibly in the earth, Shechem, Bethel, and Hebron, what do we learn? Separation, not assimilation. Shechem. Bethel, pilgrimage, not permanence. Hebron, fellowship with God by walking in the truth. So we're separate from the world. We have a pilgrimage where we are not identified with the eternities of this life. And in the end, brethren and sisters, if we settle down with all those Gentiles of like precious faith into fellowship with the great high priest of our profession, putting our footsteps firmly in the steps of that faith of our father Abraham, when he walked through the land in the length of it and in the breadth of it.